I won't say that I saw anyone high-fiving. There was certainly a sense of relief, but recognizing now we have a lot more work to do.
Shell's drill rig Cook is finally anchored. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Southeast residents reflect on the big weekend earthquake.
The quake was certainly large enough to not only wake people up, but shake things up in their houses pretty good.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
An Alaska militia member will serve nearly 26 years in a federal prison after being convicted of conspiracy to commit murder and to amass weapons. Lonnie Vernon was sentenced today during a combative session in U.S. District Court in Anchorage, at which he denied the authority of the court, the judge, and prosecutors. Judge Robert Bryan told Vernon that he was sorry Vernon's life had come to this. Vernon responded he was sorry people like Bryan run the country. The 57-year-old Vernon, along with his wife Karen, earlier pleaded guilty to planning to kill a federal judge and an Internal Revenue Service officer in a property tax dispute. Karen Vernon was sentenced to 12 years in prison. The defense attorney argued for a 5-year sentence for the 67-year-old. They say she was influenced in the plot to kill officials by her husband, but otherwise hasn't even had a traffic ticket in her life. Prosecutors asked for more than 15 years. Lonnie Vernon was a member of the Fairbanks-based Alaska Peacekeepers Militia. Shell's Kulluk drill rig has been anchored in Kaluta Bay on the east side of Kodiak Island. It took the Kulluk about 12 hours to be towed 45 miles to the bay. It was refloated a little after 10 p.m. last night. Coast Guard Captain Paul Mailer described the mood in the Incident Command Center when tugs were able to move the rig off the ocean floor.
I won't say that I saw anyone high-fiving. I'll say there was certainly a sense of relief, but recognizing now we have a lot more work to do.
The Coast Guard conducted an overflight this morning and saw no oil sheen, but some debris will have to be cleaned up from the shore near where the Kulluk was grounded. Mailer says a team is working to get a better picture of what that debris includes.
The one thing I know that is going to need to be cleaned up is we have lifeboats on the beach. Those lifeboats will have fuel. So that is this morning when we came in and sat down with the operations, now that we were moving into this, that became a higher priority of the beach assessment.
The Kulluk had been grounded near Kodiak since New Year's Eve. Environmental groups have been closely monitoring the incident. Lois Epstein is Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She is relieved the grounding doesn't appear to have caused major environmental damage.
The big picture, however, is what this incident demonstrates in terms of Shell's ability to go forward with drilling in the Arctic without serious problems.
Epstein is in Washington, D.C., where she plans to meet with members of Congress to request oversight hearings on Shell's Arctic operations.
We think that's essential. Shell's had numerous problems. They haven't been sufficiently looked at by Congress. This is a big step moving into the Arctic for drilling, and what we've learned this past year is that it's not trivial, it's dangerous.
Shell doesn't know how long the Kulluk will stay in the Kaluta Bay. That will be determined by what assessment teams, including divers or underwater vehicles, find. A list of nearly 60 bills and resolutions was released today in preparation for the upcoming legislative session in Juneau. The pre-filed bills include everything from new gas line legislation to a call for pharmacy record audits. APRN's Capitol correspondent Alexandra Gutierrez joins us now to talk about the list. Hi, Alexandra.
Hello, Ellen.
So what bills stand out to you on the list?
Well, on the energy front, there's a bill promoting an in-state gas line that would go from the North Slope down to South Central Alaska. A pretty similar bill passed the House last year, but it didn't go anywhere in the Senate. The biggest difference between this bill and the one that stalled last year is that it would turn the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation into its own agency. This and oil taxes should probably attract a lot of debate. There are also a few bills that are meant to benefit Alaska's military members. There's one that would let military members who spend more than half the year outside of Alaska on duty claim their PFD definitely, so long as they meet other residency rules. Right now, soldiers can claim an exception for 10 years, but after that, they're done. And there are also a couple of bills that would make it easier for veterans to find jobs after they leave the military, like one that would waive a skills test for a commercial driver's license if veterans have equivalent military experience. And as far as young people go, there are a few pieces of legislation that would affect them, like one bill that would bring down the cost of student loans and another item that is meant to reduce cyberbullying.
So are you seeing anything in these bills that other state legislatures are looking at?
Yes, there's one bill that would make primaries nonpartisan, so the top two winners, regardless of party, would face off in the general election. California recently switched to a top two primary system, and it's resulted in a legislature that's a lot less polarized than it used to be, and by all accounts is actually getting a lot more work done. A primary system like that would benefit more moderate legislators from both parties, and if it had been in place in 2010, it would have prevented something like the Lisa Murkowski-Joe Miller face-off that we had. A few pieces of legislation that have been controversial in other states are also being introduced. There's a standard ground law that would allow people to use self-defense in any place so long as they're not trespassing. That law came under a lot of fire in Florida after the shooting of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. And there's also a voter ID law that would require voters to show photo ID or two other forms of ID, like a birth certificate and something else, when they go to a polling place. We're seeing that introduced in a lot of other state legislatures across the country as well.
So this legislature could be a lot more conservative than the last one. Do you see anything in these bills that reflects that?
Those last few bills that I mentioned are something that we're seeing in a lot of legislatures with Republican majorities. Some of those policies are ones that have been promoted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a clearinghouse for bills that are supposed to promote free markets and conservative principles. However, we didn't see any legislation on abortion, which some people have been watching out for. But, of course, there will be another batch of pre-filed bills coming out later this week, and I'm sure there will be plenty more legislation introduced as the session picks up.
Have we seen this sort of legislation before?
We have. For example, the standard ground law that I mentioned has been introduced before, and it even passed the House, but it stalled in the Senate. That's kind of been the pattern for legislation like that. Now that Republicans have a solid majority in the Senate and the bipartisan coalition that existed before is basically done, there's a chance that more conservative legislation could have an easier time getting passed this time around.
Okay. Thank you, Alexandra.
Thank you, Ellen.
Alexandra Gutierrez is APRN's Capitol correspondent. The legislative session begins next Tuesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, inside the auto shop at a rural high school.
They like to see these things. They like to experience them. And it's something that they take with them the rest of their lives.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
An arrest has been made in connection with the fire that burned a Midtown Anchorage apartment building last week. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Late Friday, Anchorage Fire Department officials announced that Janae Collins had been arrested and charged in connection with the big Midtown Anchorage apartment fire on January 3rd. Al Tamagni is a spokesperson for the Anchorage Fire Department. He says they believe it was arson.
As a result of the investigation and interviews with residents, the fire was classified as an arson. Janae Collins, age 41 of Anchorage, was arrested and charged with arson in the first degree and reckless endangerment. She was arraigned over the weekend, but the investigation continues.
Temagni says Collins was a resident of the 24-unit apartment building, which was destroyed by fire Thursday morning. Charging documents say Collins lit an article of clothing on fire in the apartment, then took it out onto a balcony and put it in a trash can with cardboard. The fire then spread to the attic space, burning the south face of the building and the entire roof. Two residents were transported to the hospital, and two police officers suffered smoke inhalation injuries. The investigation is ongoing. A pre-indictment hearing for Collins is set for Tuesday. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The big question in Southeast Alaska this weekend was, did you feel the quake? In some communities, it was, where'd you evacuate to, or did anything break? The 7.5 magnitude earthquake struck at 11:58 p.m. on Friday, with more than a dozen weaker aftershocks following for hours. The Tembler, which some call the midnight quake, hit about 60 miles west of Craig on Prince of Wales Island. KRBD's Layla Carey talked to people in Ketchikan and on Prince of Wales Island about the quake and its after effects.
Marble Island, population 5, is about as close as you can get to the epicenter of Saturday morning's earthquake and still be on land. The small island is just off the northwest coast of Prince of Wales Island, across from Edna Bay. Cindy Wyatt lives there with her husband and two children. They were awake when the earthquake hit because one of the children had gotten up for a midnight snack. He was headed back upstairs when...
We all kind of heard this, It was almost like a roaring, but not exactly. It's a very hard noise to describe. And then the house started shaking. Wind chimes started, you know, going off and stuff.
By the time they figured out what was happening and what they should do, the quake was over. It only lasted about a minute, but...
Tsunami is the next thing to worry about, right?
They checked their VHF radio, heard the alert, and decided to head up the hill. They'd practiced this before after an earthquake off British Columbia triggered a tsunami alert in late October.
And so, you know, we know the drill. Get your warm clothes on and we'll get out there. And it just turns out that in this case, by the time we found out exactly where it was too late, really, to have gotten away from a tsunami because we were so close.
There was a tsunami wave from the earthquake, which had struck at a depth of about 3 miles. However, the tsunami wasn't large enough to be a threat. The Tsunami Warning Center reported a half-foot rise in the water level at Port Alexander and just a few inches above normal in Sitka. But Wyatt says they didn't know that and stayed up the hill for quite some time. She hopes in the future emergency alerts on the Marine Weather and Coast Guard channels will be updated more often and with more specific information.
I know from talking to my sister and some other friends that getting on Facebook, they knew more about what was going on than I did at this point. I mean, immediately, everyone, I guess, in the Southeast just about felt the earthquake and so was, you know, aware that something was going on. But yet for us out here with no cell phones and no easy internet access, it's only the VHF.
Wyatt says they don't know whether their island experienced any surge. She homeschools her children and says they'll do some research in hopes of building a system to measure any future tsunami surges. The earthquake's epicenter was about 70 miles west of Craig. Officials in that Prince of Wales Island community immediately activated their emergency response plan. That involves evacuating residents of low-lying and/or waterfront property and staging equipment in strategic locations. City planner Brian Templin says the earthquake was felt strongly in Craig.
A number of folks came into the EOC and had talked about, you know, stuff falling off the walls and that sort of thing. I don't think there was any major structural damage to anything, but the quake was certainly large enough to not only wake people up, but shake things up in their houses pretty good.
Initial reports were of a 7.7 magnitude earthquake. That later was downgraded to 7.5. After the Tembler hit, officials immediately issued a tsunami warning for all coastal areas of Southeast Alaska. The warning extended south to the northern tip of British Columbia's Vancouver Island and northwest to Cape Suckling, 75 miles southeast of Cordova. In Ketchikan, some people felt the earthquake while others slept right through the whole thing. City of Ketchikan crews checked area dams for structural damage soon after the quake and again later when there was more light. Emergency responders were on the watch as well in case a tsunami really did hit. South Tonga's Fire Department firefighter Stephen Rouge says they were aware of the earthquake right away.
The quake last night, we felt it here at Station 4 pretty well. The walls kind of started to rattle. The coffee cups on the walls were bouncing. The couches were moving around. We definitely felt it.
He says their fire chief was patrolling and keeping people updated.
Yeah, from about the time the quake happened last night, our chief, Steve Rydeen, was out in his command vehicle patrolling our district, making sure that everything was kosher. When the tsunami warning was in effect, every 30 minutes or so, he was updating our South Tongass Fire Department Facebook page.
The quake occurred along the Queen Charlotte Fault, which runs up the side of Haida Gwaii, and along the outer coast of southeast Alaska to Yakutat. In an interview following the late October earthquake, U.S. Forest Service geologist Jim Baichtal told KRBD that since 1898, which is as far back as records go, there have been 322 earthquakes along that fault, or about three per year. Of those, 34 had been greater than a magnitude 6. Now there's 35. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
There's more scientific evidence that sea otters reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That has meaning for southeast Alaska, where the population is booming, and southwest Alaska, where it's dropped. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Researchers already linked sea otters to carbon sequestration. It's a simple case of cause and effect. Kelp absorbs and stores carbon from the atmosphere. Sea urchins eat kelp, lowering the amount of carbon the marine plants take in. Otters eat urchins, allowing healthy kelp forests to grow.
Most of the carbon that's in living tissues of organisms is tied up in plants.
Chris Wilmers is an environmental studies professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
And so if plants are doing a lot better, then it stands to reason that maybe there's more carbon in the system.
Wilmers led a project to calculate the amount of the greenhouse gas otters help remove. He spoke during a recent teleconference hosted by the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy. He says scientists compared data collected over the past 40 years to more recent information. They studied sites from southern British Columbia to the end of the Aleutians, and they compared otter-rich areas to those with few of the marine mammals. Researchers found areas where otters live had 5 to 10% less atmospheric carbon than those where they don't. Wilmer says it's about the same amount 5 million cars would emit in an average year. Researchers then calculated its value on the European carbon exchange.
We looked up what the price of carbon futures were when we were writing the study. We multiplied it by the amount of carbon otters are indirectly sequestering, and it comes out to be roughly worth somewhere between $200 and $400 million.
But there's a downside. The greenhouse gases ocean plants remove from the atmosphere do not disappear.
If the kelp are taking up more carbon and sinking that carbon into the deep ocean, then, you know, over long time scales, there'll be more carbon in the ocean. So theoretically, it could increase acidification.
Scientists know higher levels of acidity damage shellfish, including crab. It may also affect salmon behavior. But Wilmers and his fellow researchers say the impacts are limited.
The real point of the study is to show that an animal, and in this case a predator, can have a big effect on the carbon cycle in its ecosystem. And if otters covered the planet, they could have a huge impact on climate change and ocean acidification. But the reality is they just occupy this little sliver of the planet. But where they do live, their impact is large.
He says otters do not remove all sea urchins, but they eat enough to drop numbers significantly. Otter populations are growing in southeast Alaska, Kachemak Bay, and some other locations. While they eat urchins, they also consume crabs, clams, and sea cucumbers. That's impacting fishermen and divers who harvest those valuable species. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting the Clare House Replacement Project. There's more information online at cssalaska.org.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
One thing teachers and parents hope to see from their students is motivation to show a little enthusiasm daily about learning something new, to embrace a challenge, to make productive use of their time in school each day. In the automotive class at Dillingham High School, students undertake routine maintenance on vehicles for free if owners provide the parts and materials. The students are not only becoming pretty good at what they do, they're also excited about doing it. KDLG's Dave Benninger noticed the student's motivation when he dropped his truck off for some maintenance.
Not just any maintenance. Ever since temperatures dropped below freezing, daily it was a crapshoot as to whether or not my truck could be obliged to start and run. It seemed there was either water in the gas tank, a faulty fuel pump, or both. I towed it into the shop at Dillingham High School and left the truck and a new fuel pump in the hands of Ray Timmerman and Kendall Alvarado, students in the automotive maintenance and repair class.
Maybe we should take that last one out and then redo it from the other side. All right. Maybe we'll go in later.
So tell me about this whole project.
We changed the fuel pump. It was a pain in the butt because these bolts didn't want to come out and then didn't want to go back in. But not everything's easy.
Do you think I take care of my truck?
No. I think you should start.
That's Ray. She really owned this project, often working at it the first three periods of the school day to see it through, and it took more than a week start to finish.
Have you guys taken on projects like this year?
No, I think this is the biggest we've done this year. Usually we're just doing oil changes and radiator fluids. So this was a big change, and it was harder, but...
You like this class, though, huh?
Yeah.
What's this class giving you the chance to do so far?
Just giving me more hands-on experience. And I'd rather spend my time working on something I want to work on than doing nothing.
Bob Burns is the shop teacher. Woodworking is more his specialty, so he learns alongside the students with each new vehicle that comes in. Much of what they see is simple maintenance, oil changes, putting on winter tires, and so on. But occasionally they get more tricky projects that give the kids a challenge they embrace. It's hands-on learning, and Burns says his students are into it.
For some students, that's more enjoyable. That's how they learn. They like to see these things. They like to experience them. And it's something that they take with them the rest of their lives. And you witness them. I mean, they're double-checking. They're checking each other, and they're making sure they're doing it right. You know, and that's all you can ask of your students, to do the best possible job they can.
Think that truck's going to run?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, the owner would be disappointed if we don't get it to operate.
My truck is older than Ray and Kendall by probably a decade, and as they're finishing reassembly, some of the bolts are refusing to go back in as intended.
Kendall, what do you think you've kind of learned here so far?
That you got to line it up. If it ain't lined up, it ain't going to go in too good.
By lunchtime, Ray and Kendall had everything reassembled and 5 gallons of clean gas in the tank.
Finally got it done after a while. It was a journey and a half, but I hope it works. It better work.
The last step was to reconnect the battery. Then Ray climbed behind the wheel and gave the key a turn. It was a tense couple of moments as presumably the new fuel pump started doing its job. Then the truck turned over and roared to life.
What do you think, kiddo?
Sounds like a success to me.
What all did you do here to get to this point?
We dropped the gas tank, took the fuel pump out, changed it, put it back in. Doesn't sound as easy as I said it is, but got it done. Started.
Nice.
It took more than a week to finish, and in the end, it worked perfectly. My truck was moved out, the next car moved in, and the kids eagerly went to work on that one. Beat that, math teachers. Impressed and driving a fine running truck in Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
When it comes to snowfall, this winter and last winter in Anchorage are wide apart. So far, the difference is more than 45 inches when comparing last year's bounty and this year's skimpy amounts of the white stuff. Last year, at about this time, Anchorage had more than 70 inches of snow. The National Weather Service says so far about 25 inches of snow has fallen in the city. The National Weather Service says snow lovers should not despair just yet. Forecasters say while things may seem sparse around town, this actually isn't a record-breaking lack of snow. They say Anchorage still has plenty of time to add to its snowfall numbers. Monday, January 7th is Christmas Day on the Julian calendar observed by Eastern Orthodox Christians. Western churches and most secular institutions follow the Gregorian calendar. In both calendars, however, Christmas falls on December 25th. This is the choir at St. Michael's Cathedral in Sitka, led by Kathy Hope Erickson, participating in the Divine Liturgy. The service this year was especially poignant since the cathedral, which was previously destroyed by fire in 1966, sits just a few feet above sea level and was at risk of inundation had a tsunami developed after last Friday's magnitude 7.5 earthquake. That all was well in Sitka on this day felt like a very big Christmas present. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.